This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by INE, the market leader in CCIE training. Interested in training with some of the most experienced Cisco certified trainers in the world? Visit INE.com today to get started. Use promo code PACKETPUSHERS to get 30 rack rental tokens with your purchase of $100 or more from now until December 31st. Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast. This is a show about data networking. If you're the person in the data center who's racking equipment and cabling things up and making sure the bits get from point A to point B, hey, that's us. This is what we're talking about. You're in the right place. Today, we've gathered around the virtual whiteboard to have a chat about Cisco Fabric Path. This is not a sponsored show. This is just us customer types who actually use the product. Well, three of the people on the show use the product. I haven't actually had a chance to work with Fabric Path myself. I've done my share of Cisco Nexus work, and the three guests that are with me today have done a good bit with Fabric Path, and they are here to share in the joy that is building a fabric. So let's introduce the three guests that we have on the show today. Before we do that, I should say who I am. I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. I'm a CCIE, working on my CCDE slowly but surely, more slowly than surely at this point. And you know me as the co-host of the Packet Pushers podcast here, writer at Network Computing, and my blog is ethancbanks.com. First guest, Jamie Caesar. Jamie, say hi and tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Okay, how you doing? Jamie Caesar. Twitter handle is J_CAE. I am also Route Switch CCIE, working on data center, a CCIE. Probably more like you, a little more slowly than surely. But maybe eventually get to it. Right now, in the past 3.5 years, worked for Presidio as a delivery engineer. So I do fortunately get my hands on a lot of this stuff fairly often. Oh. I guess that's about it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on. This show was really your idea. You pinged me an email and said, hey, I think we could do a pretty good show on Fabric Path. And so thanks for bringing it up. And the next guest with us is Mr. Colby Glass.
It's Colby. I work for Presidio as well. I used to be in Jamie's role doing the delivery stuff. I did some Fabric Path deployments, a lot of Nexus, and recently moved over to the corporate IT side. And that's about it for me.
Good deal. Thanks for coming on. And to both of you, Jamie and Colby, thanks for coming back. You guys worked with us on the OTV shows that were pretty well reviewed. And so thanks very much for taking the time to put the outline together for the show and come on back to spend some more time around the microphone. And at your recommendation, we've got a third guest here, Ed Diaz. Ed, nice to meet you.
Hi, guys. I'm Ed Diaz. I'm actually working as a network architect for a big healthcare organization. We are actually a Presidio customer. That's how I met Colby in the past. We recently implemented a new Nexus environment with Fabric Path, and we actually did a couple of OTV scenarios to facilitate the data center move.
Thanks for coming on board and sharing with your experiences today. It's nice to hear from the people that are actually on the ground implementing stuff to know more of the real world of what's going on. You know, we have sponsored shows on the podcast, of course, which is important. We get to hear from the engineers and the people that are actually designing the products from their perspective. But the customer perspective is always a little different. So it's great that that we're all together to have this Fabric Path discussion. And why don't we start off with Jamie? Why don't you give folks a definition of what Cisco Fabric Path is? And we'll take the conversation from there.
Sure. So Fabric Path is basically a replacement for Spanning Tree. It, I guess with Spanning Tree, we have the limitation of regardless of how many redundant links we add, it always blocks all of them except for one path. And with Fabric Path, we can actually use multiple paths. We get equal cost multipath pathing. It's really more of a routed behavior that we get to apply to layer two. And in fact, I'm sort of stealing this explanation from one of the ways I heard it explained in a presentation a while ago from Cisco is, you know, everyone blames Spanning Tree and says Spanning Tree is, you know, all these problems that we have to deal with. But really, it's, I mean, Spanning Tree is required. We need it because the blind forwarding that bridges do on their own is, you know, packet comes in, I don't know where it goes, so I'm going to send it everywhere except the packet, except from the path where I received it. And so that's what leads to our loops, and why I have to block these paths. And so I guess Fabric Path is really also a replacement for that forwarding behavior, and it changes at that level as well, so that we can actually use multiple paths without having to worry about things circulating forever if spanning tree isn't there.
Yeah. I'll add that Fabric Path is based on Trill. Now, it is not standard IETF Trill as such, but it is based on that. So if you're thinking about, you know, well, what's this like? It's like Trill as opposed to shortest path bridging. It is not shortest path bridging. It is more like Trill. But again, not Trill standard. Just like Brocade's VCS is not Trill standard. And in fact, Fabric Path and Brocade VCS are not interoperable, for what it's worth. But they're both, as Jamie said, effectively layer two routing. And in fact, there is a routing protocol under the hood, Jamie, that's used to do basically MAC routing.
Yes, it's ISIS is used under the covers, mostly because it doesn't run an IP. It's not dependent on IP, so it was easy to fit into this role. And I'm sure we'll get more into this a little bit later too. I would say it's not even necessarily MAC routing, and we'll get into this. But there's a switch ID for each bridge. And the routing only exchanges information on how to reach the different bridges. And, through the conversational learning process, again, that we'll talk about, the MACs or the association between which switch a MAC address lives at is learned. And then the ISIS tells us how to reach that bridge.
Yeah, that's what makes it a little bit different than OTV, where the actual MAC addresses are being advertised between the devices. In this case, it's just switch IDs, so there's no there's no control plane learning of MAC addresses through advertisements.
So now, one of the benefits of this topology doing any sort of layer two learning and forwarding, I mean, the big one is like you said, spanning trees blocking a lot of paths. Well, when you get into data center design and even campus design to a certain degree, you've got 10 gig links and maybe 40 gig links that are awfully pricey to be putting in your data center. You want to be forwarding across all those links. You don't want to have a lot of them sitting around unused because spanning tree to keep control of the topology has blocked links. That's the one big thing that I think folks look at and go, yeah, okay. Well, Colby, why don't you give us some other benefits here?
There are a lot of benefits. In the data center world, you've got, or at least in the Cisco Nexus data center world, you've got two choices for basically data center connectivity aside from spanning tree. You've got VPC and you've got Fabric Path. VPC is really rigid. It's got supported topology, two switches as the VPC peers, and then however many downstream switches. Whereas Fabric Path, you can use an arbitrary topology. You can have six switches connected in various different ways, or five or three. So that's one big benefit, in my opinion, over VPC. And then there's also that it's much simpler to configure. There are a lot less knobs that are required for day-to-day usage, whereas with VPC, you have all different peer gateway, peer switch, all kinds of different things that you can turn on and probably should turn on, but nobody really knows what they do. So that's a benefit of Fabric Path over VPC. And in general, Fabric Path's benefit is that, like you said, I mean, you've any-to-any connectivity and multi-link forwarding, huge multipathing.
There's also what Cisco calls conversational learning, in that only the bridges, only the, I would even say the leaf bridges, and maybe I should even take a step back farther, is, a standard topology that we deploy this is there's the spine, which is sort of the core switches that would more than likely be 7Ks. It doesn't have to be, it could be other 5Ks, but very often it is, or your 7Ks. Then you have all your 5Ks that may be out at, end of row or something like that. And those 5Ks would all be the leaf nodes that attach to the servers, or have 2Ks that attach to servers. And when two devices are talking to each other, only the two edge devices that are a part of that conversation even have to learn that MAC address. No other bridges in the system or the whole Fabric Path domain need to know that, because all the Fabric Path devices are making their decisions based on those switch IDs. So that allows for much greater scalability, because not every device has to know every MAC address. It only has to know the ones that it's involved in conversations with.
Yeah, I'm glad you're clarifying that, because that obviously clears up a misconception that I had. I'm thinking about, tables of MAC addresses, and that's wrong the way Fabric Path is deployed. You're dealing with these switch IDs instead.
That's exactly right. I guess really the only difference that from what people are used to seeing is right now people are used to seeing, you know, I do a show MAC address table and you get that list of MAC addresses. And for each one, it says, well, here's my outgoing port. This MAC address is out this port. This MAC address is out this port. The main change is now when you do the show MAC address table, if it's a local device, you'll still see the same thing. Here's my MAC address table and here's this port. For anything that's learned across Fabric Path, you'll see here's my MAC address table and here's my destination switch ID. So, you know, again, that part still stays the same. You know, then sort of the next step is you have to look at how Fabric Path says, what's my routes to that switch ID? And that's sort of the next step in troubleshooting. That's sort of the extra step, I guess you would say, if you're troubleshooting in Fabric Path versus standard classic Ethernet, as it's referred to when you're deploying Fabric Path.
The big advantage I had moving into Fabric Path, unlike VPC, I came from a Catalyst environment. And the biggest thing we did was VSS in some scenarios. When I went through the configuration of VPC versus Fabric Path, it was night and day. So there's no consistency checks that you have to worry about. It became really simple to deploy the topology. And we went in and we did a side-by-side configuration of VPC versus Fabric Path. And it took us 5 minutes to do Fabric Path versus with VPC. We actually ran into issues as we were demoing what the configuration would look like. So the simplicity of VPC is in itself as big as Fabric Path is as big as advantage. And another thing that we saw a lot, we actually have two data centers with two companies within my organization. As they start deploying the Nexus environment, it becomes possible for us to do, you know, two spines in two different data centers without having the fear of breaking two data centers due to spanning tree issues. So that would be another use case. If you have a metro environment where you have more than one data center, you could use Fabric Path to extend your topology between two data centers. And I believe to a smaller degree, Colby had done that in one of his Fabric Path deployments.
I got to ask for some clarification here from you guys, because you're both comparing VPC with Fabric Path, which I don't see as competing technologies necessarily. I look at VPC to accomplish what its name suggests. It's really for a multi-chassis ether channel is how I look at it as its primary focus. And yeah, I've built out virtual port channel domains that have, you know, switch to switch. Multi-chassis ether channel built between the two of them, but I really see its primary benefit for the host-facing ports so that you get physical redundancy for your host uplinks onto two different devices, whether that's FEXs, if you're doing enhanced VPC, or like up to a 5K, whatever, something like that. And you're saying, yeah, well, comparing this to Fabric Path is...
Well, we're comparing VPC to Fabric Path in the core to, you know, in the switch to switch connectivity. So anywhere that Fabric Path applies, we're comparing it to VPC, because that was the typical design before Fabric Path. I mean, Jamie, I'm sure you can speak to that. It was always, you know, 7Ks VPC peers down to some 5Ks, probably back to back VPC, and then eVPC down to your 2Ks. So that was the big thing I wanted to get rid of, was that VPC in the middle. I mean, VPC the host, you're never going to get rid of that. And it works well. It's great. You know, there are some issues.
Okay. That was an important clarification to make. So some people sitting here going, wait a minute. So with Fabric Path, I can get rid of VPC everywhere? Well, not everywhere, actually. You'd still have VPC out at the edge, but Fabric Path in the core. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Not all the hardware supports it today. And, you know, we don't know when everything's going to be supported anyways. If you're talking to the whole side and even some of the Cisco products like UCS, Fabric Path is not there yet. So we probably need to make that distinction.
I meant to even clarify on that as we got into this, and that we are comparing it to VPC. You know, most of the problems I see that we run into with VPC, some of the weird quirky stuff, always seems to be between the 7Ks and 5Ks. So when you have multiple layers of it going down to your access. So, you know, definitely that's where putting in Fabric Path instead, you know, makes that much more simple, as, you know, both Ed and Colby have said. But VPC doesn't even completely go away, because you still use VPC at the edge of Fabric Path if you desire. And at that point, they call it VPC Plus, which it's really exactly the same in every fashion, except really your peer link is now Fabric Path link. Yeah. And there's one other thing, too, that we'll probably mention later. But, you know, it still operates exactly the same as it used to, but you're really just doing it at the edge. And like we mentioned, you got the consistency checks, and you can't do layer three routing, you know, dynamic routing to those VPC devices over the VPC links.
Yeah.
You know, there's all this stuff that those restrictions all go away with Fabric Path.
Yeah. So let's take another step here. We've kind of explained Fabric Path at a high level conceptually what it is. Now, if I'm a Cisco customer and I want to run Fabric Path, you know, what are the requirements? I know the specific hardware that's involved. I mean, part of this is that there's special frame encapsulation that has to happen and is done in hardware so that you get scale. So not every Nexus device can do it. So what hardware are we looking at, first of all?
The hardware is going to be the Nexus platform, obviously. You've got the 7Ks with F-series modules. So you've got F1, F2, and F2E. Those all support Fabric Path. But, you know, as most know, there's a lot of caveats. So if you have M cards, those exist with the F1 cards, and you can only run Fabric Path at the F ports in that VDC. And then the same, the F2 cards can live in their own VDC. Those all the ports support Fabric Path. And then the F2E is the same, similar as the F1, where you can run Fabric Path, but only on the F ports, not on the M ports.
In the F series of cards, there's an F3 that was announced at Cisco Live US, right?
Yeah, is that shipping yet? I wasn't going to talk about it.
Yeah, it's just worth mentioning because I know it's had a new ASIC on it that was all singing, all dancing. And I remember Ron Fuller was pretty excited about the F3 that I think does away with some of the caveats that you just mentioned about the F2
cards. Yeah, in theory, you're going to be able to get rid of the M and the F cards, right? The F3, for the most part, unifies the functionality. I think it's still got like FIB limitations, but it's a pretty end-all, be-all card.
Still, at a reasonable cost, too. Still right. Some dollars there, but I think it was supposed to beat the price of an M card, for sure. So anyway, I didn't mean to get off track there, other than to raise awareness that there's an F3 either out or going to be out pretty soon that may impact the conversation going forward if you're talking to your Cisco rep about designing a Fabric Path solution. Anyway.
Right, exactly. So you have the F3 card as well, and then you have the 5Ks and the 6Ks. So only the 5500, not the 5000 support Fabric Path. And it's a license on every platform so far. So it's either in the bundle or it's a separate license. And then you also have the 6K. So the 6004 and the 6001 support it. So pretty much everything in the Nexus world except like the 3000 and the M cards, I think. And then the old 5Ks. I think that's about right. Jamie or Ed can jump in if that's...
Yeah, you can't do it on 1000B, but yeah, that's basically right.
That's a good point too. And the UCS Fabric Interconnects don't support it either. So
I think the licensing has come down quite a bit on this over the years as well.
The licensing thing, they have the limited time promo that you can get all the features, including all the layer 3 stuff on the 5K, and it's cheaper than piecemealing Fabric Path with something else. So you end up getting it for a very, very good price where it makes sense to just get it.
Yeah, and as usual, if you can get the license bundled up front with your major purchase, that's probably going to be the way to go. If you're not sure if you want it or not, see if you can get Cisco to throw it in for little or no cost to the overall purchase. They're going to be more inclined to do it there rather than you go back later and say, hey, I want to add Fabric Path now. It tends to be harder for them to give you a price break at that point.
Yeah, that's actually what we did on Ed's project. They weren't sure if they were going to go VPC in the core or Fabric Path, so they ended up luckily buying all the licenses they needed with the promo. And then, you know, once they decided they were going to go that way, it was easy.
So if someone was looking at this and said, hey, I want to do F2 cards, because those tend to come in at a really attractive price for the features that you get, there's some downsides to that if you're dealing with Fabric Path, right?
I don't think there's downsides to the F2 cards in relation to Fabric Path. I mean, first of all, everybody should be buying F2E at this point, right, Jamie? I mean, there's no reason to buy the old F2. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, the F2E, I believe, is the same price. So, yeah, there'd be no reason to go with the standard F2. And the F2E does allow you to put it back in that similar mode as the F1, where you can proxy right off the M cards, but you can now put them in the same VDCs. But there are, and I guess your point was, yeah, it's not a limitation around Fabric Path, but right. To be aware that when you go with an all F2 design, there's a few things that you may not have versus the M cards, just so people can decide, well, I don't really use those features anyway, so F2 sound great, or ooh, I really need that feature. And maybe, Ed, you were the one that kind of filled in on this, so I'll let you
So there were no limitations on Fabric Path itself. Some of the features that we lost was real NetFlow on the F2 modules. We decided that that wasn't a big problem for us. We were going to capture NetFlow somewhere else. The other issue that we had, and it was a limitation until recently, was that we were going to try and use the 7K for ER span termination for some on-demand 1000V sessions. And we overlooked that when we were looking at our design. And on the F-series as well, and I don't think that has scaled too much yet, we have a limited TCAM size on the cards. So we were running WCCP on our 7Ks, and we started having issues with the redirection because we didn't have enough TCAM resources to allocate the three or four different service groups we had. So we had to adjust for that.
Are those pretty beefy redirect lists that you're dealing with? I mean, you got to imagine if you're exhausting TCAM, I mean, it's still not nothing on an F2 card. There's still some size there, but...
So in our case, it was a blue coat based content filtering, and by default, it tries to create 64 buckets for WCCP redirection. So every entry in the ACL occupies that many resources on TCAM. So basically, we had about 150 lines times 64 buckets times four service groups. We were over. So when you go and you allow it, the service group on the interface, if it can't apply it across the board, it will just tell you that it can't do it.
Yeah.
So we had to tweak the settings on the cache appliances themselves to accommodate for that.
That is a really interesting story because you wouldn't think 150 lines of anything would ever impact your TCAM, but it did. Correct. In this specific scenario because of the way Blue Coat is implementing WCCP.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in normal scenario, no problem, right? But we actually troubleshoot that for a couple hours, and Colby was involved, and we just ended up changing some settings on the Blue Coat appliance. I believe if you're going with IronPort, and we actually demoed IronPort as well, it's more intuitive on how to tweak that, but it's still a limitation as you keep scaling your model. And our ACL entries are based on exceptions that for some reason when we sent something to the cache engine, it was breaking the sessions. So that always gets bigger with time. It never goes down. So in the future, we're going to run into some other limitation as well. And that's a feature of the F2, not having enough TCAM space.
And that is one thing that Cisco, you know, they jumped in with this conversational learning to address that, because the F cards are notoriously small TCAM. So that theoretically helps a lot with the scale, but it's never going to help with WCCP ACLs and other things that take up TCAM, sadly.
But it's also part of why the F2 cards can be priced where they are, and conversely, why the M cards are as expensive as they are. The amount of TCAM is certainly a big part of that equation. 7Ks, 5500s, not 5000s. Nexus 6Ks can do it, not 3Ks. And then there's a licensing attribute to it. And then you need the right line card that can do Fabric Path. But generally speaking, it's pretty broadly supported across the Nexus product line. Just pay attention to what you're doing and make sure you got a rep that's very familiar with doing a Fabric Path install to make sure you get everything spec'd like you need. Once you're past that hurdle, then you can actually get into doing some deployment here. So why don't we talk about how Fabric Path actually works? Let's get into the nuts and bolts a little bit. Jamie, you want to kick this off, get people's brains thinking about what moving traffic through Fabric Path is like?
Yep, I can do that. And I actually wanted to jump in real quick on the previous conversation, just to add to what Ed said, or maybe to add a little more clarity to it. He said there's not, you know, real NetFlow in the F2 cards. And what it is it's sampled NetFlow. So you get, you know, you can set the sampling rate, but, you know, it picks up like one packet out of every couple thousand or something. So that's what he meant. If you're wondering what not real NetFlow was, is you can miss things that way if there's small flows that may not get caught in the samples.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, on how it works, we mentioned a little bit briefly earlier, but every switch will have a switch ID and it will automatically pick one, which isn't always ideal because you probably want to give it a number that makes sense to you. So when you see that number in your MAC address table, you automatically know which switch it is. But that switch ID is a number between, you know, 1 and 4,094. That you can assign it to. So you got a lot of room to play with, you know, how you want to allocate those. The ISIS process exchanges that. It learns all the reachability, to how it reaches all of those switch IDs. And then once a packet comes into one of the edge fabric path devices, it'll do that lookup in its table. It knows which switch ID it's that traffic is that needs to go to, and then it encapsulates it in the fabric path header.
Let me back you up just a second. So ISIS learns about all the switch IDs. So there's a discovery process there where all the switches that are participating in fabric path learn about each other. And then there's many paths that, depending on just how everything's been cabled up, many paths that could be followed to get from one switch ID to another across fabric path. And ISIS is taking care of all of that magic.
Correct.
And in that sense, it's like any routing protocol. So if you're familiar with an interior routing protocol like EIGRP or OSPF, you could do similar sorts of topologies, end up with paths that are computed based on an algorithm. He figures out the shortest path to get from one place to another out of the multitude of different paths that there might be. And now he knows I've got an entry in my my forwarding table. This is how I'm going to get there. Okay. But then the one other piece I wanted you to expand on, then he knows how to get from switch ID to switch ID, but how does that help us with, you know, host-to-host communication, which is really what we're accomplishing? And you mentioned the encapsulation there, but just talk through that process.
Like I said, a packet maybe hits the, if you want to call it the ingress, or that leaf node that has the classic Ethernet up to this 5K, let's say, and that 5K does a MAC address lookup, and he says, okay, that's switch 25. Is where that MAC address lives. So at that point, he'll encapsulate, he'll take, you know, the MAC address, the MAC header, you know, pretty much the whole packet, layer two and all, and puts the fabric path header in front of it. And there is a source switch ID, which says, you know, I'm coming. If that was switch ID 10, let's say, he'll put 10 in the source, and he'll put 25 as the destination, and then look at the fabric path routing table and say, okay, so now to reach 25, I need to send it either down this link, or I have equal cost links, and, you know, I have an algorithm I use to choose which one I'm going to send it on, and it sends it off. And the next fabric path bridge that receives that will look at the destination, just like in IP routing, and will say, oh, that's going to switch 25. So let me look at my fabric path routing table and decide which links to send that to. Eventually gets to switch 25. He realizes that's for himself. We'll pull off the fabric path header, you know, look at that destination MAC address, compare it against his MAC address table, which would say, oh, well, that's out of local port, you know, E1/5, or, you know, let's say, and it will forward it classic Ethernet.
Yeah.
Just like any other bridge.
Yep. Delivers it like a normal Ethernet frame, you know, standard process we're familiar with at that point, once it's made its way across the fabric and is decapsulated. Yeah. Okay. Another question here is regarding cost. As the fabric path switches learn about each other and learn the paths through the fabric to get to one another, do they know the difference between a 1 gig link, a 10 gig link, and a 40 gig link, let's say, and then assign different costs to it? Do we know how the metrics are computed, I guess, is the question.
Yep, it is based on bandwidth by default.
Hey, let somebody else jump in there, Hog.
I almost said that. I almost said that. And I was like, that wasn't in the thing. So,
dude, this is an easy one. Let me do this one.
Colby's all you.
Yeah, so it's similar to, you know, real ISIS OSPF. It's got a reference bandwidth that will be taken into consideration for the metric across all the links. And then it can equally load balance across 16, I believe, you know, between two devices.
Just like with any other protocol, you can go ahead and hard code it to a particular bandwidth to influence the metric. If you leave it all alone, it works pretty well. But you can go ahead, and I believe in our deployment, we were testing and we ran out of cables. So we had to artificially change the metrics to make it look that it was more convenient to go up to the spine and back down than to go, you know, across to the other peer, the other access layer switch at the edge of the row. So we had to artificially change the metric, and it behaved just as expected. You know, we changed the reference bandwidth to 10 gigs, for example, and it calculated everything. And, I mean, the metrics are all predictable, just like they would be with EIGRP or OSPF.
We wanted the traffic to traverse the peer link, right? And but it was actually going up to the 7Ks for each of the little pods.
Yes.
So we had to manually set the metric.
Correct. We had two hoses. on the A and B side of the same row, and they were going actually up to the spine and back down to the other 7K, to the other 5K. And what we wanted to do was to transverse that VPC link that we had. So we had to artificially change the bandwidth while we ran more cables.
So then getting back to the process of actually forwarding across, we talked through, kind of did a packet walk there from, you know, ingress switch, host-facing switch to the egress switch across the fabric on the other end. But all of that presumed that the fabric knew about the destination MAC and where it lived. And so it was a pretty straightforward process. But of course, that isn't always the situation. Sometimes it's an unknown MAC that you're trying to forward to. What happens in a fabric path environment in that case? I mean, we know in a regular Ethernet environment, there is flooding that happens. The switch gets a frame with a destination MAC he does not have. He floods it out of all ports except for the one that the frame came in on. What happens with fabric path?
It's essentially the same process in that regard. So fabric path builds multi-destination trees. So what that basically is like a spanning tree. It's a loopless topology. It's got two trees, one's for unknown unicasts and multicasts, and the other one's for multicasts, I believe, right? Or broadcasts and unknown unicasts.
The first tree is the unknown unicasts and any broadcasts, and then some multicast traffic, and the second tree is the remainder of that multicast.
That multicast, okay. So basically those are blocked links. There's a priority that you set to decide who's going to be the root of each tree, well, of the trees. So you set your priority. Switch one becomes the root for multi-destination tree one, and then the next preferred switch becomes the root for destination switch two or destination tree two. And then an unknown unicast or broadcast is going to go throughout that tree as opposed to just flooding everywhere. So it works almost like spanning tree with unknown unicasts and broadcasts.
Okay, so we've got a pretty good idea of how fabric path works and how it forwards frames. There's some other conversations that we could get into maybe another time. We could get into a little more detail on, say, multicast and how that tree gets built and multicast packets forwarded across across the fabric path topology. But let's move on from that for now and talk about some design considerations. Now, one of the things you guys have been talking about that I wanted to expand on a little bit for folks. You have mentioned leafs and spines. Now, that is in any sort of a fabric design, typically the way it is done. But folks that are used to a three-layer design, access layer, distribution layer, core layer, may not be overly familiar with what leaf and spine might look like. Ed, did you guys actually deploy leaf spine in your fabric path deployment?
Yeah, so we have, I believe it's 12 leaf switches, and they're 5Ks, and then we have 2 7Ks as spines, and we have the we assign the switch IDs in a manner that makes sense to us, even though initially if you let it just run, it will just pick a random switch ID. And we actually set the priority on the spine so that it is the root of the instance of fabric path. I believe one is a primary, the other one is secondary, and the other 5Ks are at a default priority.
So just to think through this topology in our minds, you've got two spine switches, which would be roughly like core switches, and you've got, how many did you say, 12 leaf switches?
Correct.
And so as far as the cabling topology, is each leaf switch dual-homed, one to one spine switch and one to the other spine switch?
Correct. So we have today 80 gigs uplinks between each leaf switch into the spines, 42 each. And then we have 40 gigs between the two access layer switches that serve the A and B function or the VPC peers at the access layer.
Now, you could, plausibly, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you could plumb the leaf switches to each other as well if you wanted to with fabric path.
Correct, yes. Well, you could, and that's where the benefit of the ISIS running in the background from, you know, compared to traditional spanning tree, there is no ports that should be blocking at the access layer when you look at it. And also, you know, there's a little feel in the fabric path frame, the TTL, which works just like layer 3 TTL, there is no infinite loop. You could have, if you had a software glitch, you could have a loop, but that TTL should expire as it goes between fabric path switches, and at some point it will stop flooding. So that's one of the benefits that allows you to do that, a little bit more complex topology, because you don't have the concern of creating a loop. If you do, there are safeguards in the protocol that should keep it from happening.
And from a scale perspective, another aspect of leaf spine is you can scale the spine larger as well. So right now you've got, right now your leaf spine topology isn't too far from just a two-layer design, access with a collapsed core distribution layer, everybody's dual homes. People might be thinking about that going, well, that's not, you know, very different from what I've got today. But what could be different is you could have a third or a fourth or more spine switch if you wanted to, for scale and for redundancy.
Absolutely. And that's something that you will not get with VPC. So with VPC, you can only have two switches at your collapsed core. So that's the advantage of fabric path.
Or even spanning tree, because you add that, you know, third core and all of his links are going to be blocking.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't have to make the decision if you were running spanning tree. You could try to do load sharing, changing priorities across three or four different switches, but that is a very manual process. And it's really hard for you to scale that. So if you do a fabric path deployment, you just scale sideways on the spines, and you don't have to worry about making the decisions what VLAN should be prioritized where.
Yeah, you just said a big thing there, because, I mean, part of the driver for a design like this would be you've got a lot of east-west traffic, a lot of traffic not in the same row, perhaps, or not within the same switch. You're actually going between switches, or maybe between pods if it's a big data center design, that need big bandwidth between them at layer two. So you're pumping this traffic out of the rack or out of the pod into the spine switch, back out of the spine, back up to the other switch at layer two. But you've got a big bunch of non-blocking bandwidth there that's facilitating that. And again, in some cases, if you wanted to skip the spine layer, you could actually build a link between top of rack or end of row switches, if that topologically made sense for your particular application.
While we're kind of talking about all the spine stuff, I mean, Colby, you kind of made you got the note in there that you definitely wanted to talk about how the spine doesn't necessarily have to learn any MAC addresses. Did you want to speak to that part?
No, because you ruined it for me, man.
We can edit that part out. You can just pretend like you jumped right in.
No. I mean, you ruined the spine is going to learn regardless, because the SVIs, like, that never clicked, and I never happened to do a show MAC address table, like, or at least never noticed it. So no, I mean, it's not as important now, because who the hell is running a layer two spine, at least, you know, in my
experience. No connectivity out of it.
The point that you're making here is the spine switches don't necessarily need to know MAC addresses at the edge, because all they're going to learn is switch IDs. They're topologically
exactly
in the middle of the fabric.
Right.
Exactly.
So if you have all these 7Ks with F2s and small TCAM, even without conversational learning, you've still got this benefit if you're not running layer 3, if it's strictly layer 2 only spine, where, I mean, you can scale huge because all the spine is learning is are switch IDs. So if it's got any frame that it has, it doesn't care about that source or destination MAC. It just cares about the destination switch ID. Mm. So it's a huge benefit if you have this perfect world scenario, which I haven't seen, and honestly didn't even realize wasn't my perfect world scenario until Jamie pointed it out.
Well, the perfect world scenario you're referring to, meaning these spine switches aren't doing layer 3 forwarding. There's some other switches that are doing that are kind of plugged in off the edge of the fabric, if you will.
Yeah, just straight
at?
Up $200,000 7Ks that are layer 2 only, basically. That's what I haven't seen before. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I don't know how feasible that is. I'm sure, you know, maybe Facebook-sized data centers are doing it, but the customers I've worked with, they're not putting all that money into just layer 2 7Ks.
No, I have seen that as like a reference design where the fabric is, you know, all layer 2, and then there's these two big switches off to the side that are doing your layer 3. So as long as you're doing layer 2 and everything is in the fabric, that's fine. And then, you know, the layer 3 inner VLAN stuff is elsewhere.
And the one little detail that we can I don't think we specifically called out on why this changes when you have your SVIs there is because obviously those routers have to know everyone's MAC address to send traffic to them once it gets routed to that device. So yeah, kind of like Colby was saying, it was kind of my disappointment as well. I was labbing this up. expecting to see, because, you know, you'll see all the marketing material and stuff talks about, you know, there's no learning on the spines. But yeah, once your SVIs are there and they're actually routing traffic, well, now it has to know it because it's got the ARP table and it has to learn. And now you see these massive, you know, MAC address tables, and you're like, where did this come from? Until you kind of put it together and go, oh yeah, that's why it's there. So
that's why it's there, because we didn't buy enough hardware to match the white paper. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We're going to end the show there this week. There is more to come on Cisco Fabric Path. We did record another hour or so of content on this topic, so stay tuned to packetpushers.net and look for part two of this program. Packetpushers.net is our home base. You can find all of our content there, including our community blog. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. If you have any questions about this show, please email packetpushers@gmail.com. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.